Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks.
Hi, and I'm Noah Richman.
And we are here to talk today about the second pair of Welcome to the Blumhouse films, Nocturne and Evil Eye.
That's right.
So first off, just a quick... just a quick overview. Did these two feel different, or did you enjoy them more or less than last week's?
I think on the whole, for me it was an interesting one because. Last week's were both films that I thought had some really good things to them, but also had enough filler where I just felt like the downtime was too much. This week, the film Nocturne actually did not bore me at all. I found myself really completely engaged with the film the entire way through. My issue was that at the end, it just didn't really make sense. and Evil Eye was, for me, just an overall... I would say Evil Eye for me was a complete disappointment as a horror film. Now, granted, I think pretty much this entire Welcome to the Blumhouse, while there's definitely good things to be said for what some of these films are doing, I would say for something that's being released in October, clearly using the Blumhouse name, looking to capitalize on the Halloween season, I don't think any of these really live up as a horror film if you're mm-hmm. looking for something scary and spooky and atmospheric.
I will agree with that.
But Evil Eye in particular for me was one where I actually found when it tried to add any kind of quote unquote horror element, it actually detracted from anything that was charming that the film had going for it.
Well, the one thing I think I actually emailed it to you because it's in an older set of press releases that Amazon and Blumhouse released, I think back in July or August, and I didn't notice it in the later ones. And it says, sharing the spine-tingling suspense that's a Blumhouse signature, each film presents a distinctive vision and unique perception on common themes centered around family and love as redemptive or destructive forces. There's zero mention of horror in that at all.
Right. Yeah, which, you know, that's fair that that's what they're doing, but to me... the fact that you're releasing it in October kind of let's be honest.
They're aiming it for October. They are hyping up the Blumhouse connection. So everybody is expecting horror, and what they are getting are psychological suspense or you can't even say family connected horror because they're not really horror. They might edge a little bit away from suspense into thriller territory, but these are not horror as we have grown up knowing. These are horrific things that happen to unsuspecting individuals or families, shaking up what they have come to establish as a, quote, normal family dynamic. But these are not horror. because I just thinking about them again and again, I'm like, no, these are not horror. One of them, Black Box, veers into science fiction. Nocturne is kind of a ghost story, but it's not, the ghost isn't doing anything. And Evil
I would
Eye.
say Nocturne would be a horror film the way Twin Peaks would be a horror film.
You'd have to have an extremely tame definition of horror. And Evil Eye is a terrible happenstance around the karmic circle, if you want to call it that. None of these
Right.
fall into horror. And I
Yeah, and
have
the lie
seen,
is really a suspense thriller in the classic sense.
And for comparison, in the middle of four different movies I watched this weekend, The Wolf of Snow Hollow. That's definitely horror. It keeps you dancing on the edge of trying to figure out what the hell is going on here. And there are some, just for sake of non-spoilers, gruesome kills. And an unexplained killer, and it's a horror movie. And that, I think that is what sort of crystallized for me. I'm like, I'm waiting for the horror, and these are not horror. So if I look at them as thrillers or suspense, then my unease at not being able to put my finger on the horror element that I'm looking for goes away.
Right.
Now, that's not to say these are badly done films. These are very good stories. They vary in quality and timing, but overall, they're very good. And I just found out that Evil Eye is based on an Audible original. Same writer for both the audio story and the screenplay. So I'm like, I think I need to check out that Audible original because I'm curious now. I want to see if either one of them went deeper into the story premise. But which one shall we talk about first?
Well, let's go ahead and I guess I'll start with Evil Eye. So I'll say, the thing that was interesting about Evil Eye was I'm somebody that's not really watched any of the comedy stuff that, from Mindy Kaling. And I walked away from it thinking, maybe I ought to go check some of those shows out, like her or, what's the one that she produced with the high school girl, Maitreya? Well, either way, the thing that was neat about Evil Eye was the engaging way that it shows Indian culture and Indian family, and particularly an Indian American experience where, there's a girl going back and forth between both cultures and she really is like there's a self empowerment kind of theme going on with it, and I liked the way that it had a strong, powerful female lead, and that there was this entertaining look at the Indian culture and the way that she has this constant back and forth with her mother about, why aren't you married? You're already 27. And, and at the same time, this young college graduate woman, making her way in the world and trying to make her way in America. And I thought that the characters were just fun characters. They were engaging. So the thing that I liked about the movie was the charm element about it, but then once they started trying to introduce this, this this theme, this kind of ominous reincarnation theme, it really just didn't seem to match. For me, I just felt like it just didn't gel, and I felt like when they tried introducing horror elements, instead of adding to any kind of sense of interest or suspense, it actually just seemed to detract from what the film really had going for it, which was this charming interplay and back and forth with the mother and the daughter. And by the time it was over, I really just found the whole way it was handling the reincarnation theme and the I the dominant aggressor male reincarnating, the way that it handled it just didn't work for me. Like, it just seemed a little too like, well, then he just keeps dying and he keeps coming back exactly the same. Like, it's almost like nobody ever really has to die then. Like, there's different ways that you can understand and portray reincarnation. And to me, this was one that I just didn't buy into. It was a little too almost like death doesn't even really matter then for me.
Oh, I see what they were doing with the reincarnation element, and the problem, the little sticking point I had with it was the mother fixated on how long it was before he came back that time. And the impression I got at the end was that his return was immediate. And that's not the way I believe they handle or they understand or accept reincarnation. I could be wrong. This could be a cultural thing that I am unaware of, and I'm willing to go do some digging, but the whole karma thing, which is what the daughter was hyping on, what it seemed, let's just say the reincarnation at the end seemed too fast. It should not have been, it should not have been implied as an immediate thing. So that's where my sticking point is. The rest of the story, I don't think they were trying to introduce that as a horror element, believe it or not. I believe they were trying to introduce him as a dread, a hurdle that both mother and daughter had to overcome to reclaim their full power. And the I let's just say I got a different impression from the mom and the daughter, and that could be just having an understanding of how women can be the target of toxic masculinity, even though they did nothing wrong. And that in itself is a type of horror. So I don't think the supernatural angle of it was the horror that was introduced. It was the pattern that you sometimes hear about of a guy who's controlling, a guy who's narcissistic, the gaslighting, the mind games, going from the perfect gentleman to the perfect terror. And once they become the perfect terror, you're in a position where you can't escape because you're living in his house. You're living off his money. You have no resources because he effectively separated you from them. You don't have your own finances because on purpose he separated you from being able to make your own money. You have no family support. You have no friends. Did you notice how her friends disappeared? After he got her the apartment, you did not see her friends again. He made sure to monopolize her time. I mean, he's sitting there in the apartment with her while she's trying to write. And when she stops writing to make a phone call, to answer a phone call, he is all of a sudden on edge. It's like, you're not writing. What are you doing? That is classic narcissistic controlling behavior. And that gets deadly. We see it day in and day out. A guy kills a girlfriend. A guy kills an ex-girlfriend. You know, he might have moved on and gotten himself a new girlfriend. But when his old girlfriend is getting married or is pregnant with some other guy, he's going to kill her because that's not his. How dare she not be his property anymore? Even though they've gone their separate ways, he still has in the back of his mind, she's mine. And if she doesn't come back to me, I will eradicate her so I don't have to deal with that. It doesn't rise to like a Blumhouse feature horror film, but there's an undercurrent of dread in there that isn't supernatural and doesn't need to be. So
I can see all that. And, you know, it's a valid point. Certainly, one of my issues is one of going into it with certain expectations. I mean, it's called The Evil Eye, mm-hmm. and the mother is obviously very engaged with all, you know, with a lot of superstition and, mm-hmm. You know, belief in wearing your charms and checking the, you know, astrological forecast and that kind of thing. And so for me, I was just braced waiting for, you know, some sort of mm-hmm. demon to be summoned or mm-hmm. some sort of, you know, real like crazy plot twist. And
I was looking for a connection to the charm bracelet that the daughter was wearing that she accidentally broke and no longer wore. I literally was waiting for a connection between a charm or a piece of jewelry that was connected to him as a reason for him coming back. And you know what? I think this is another movie that suffered from a poorly chosen title. That's really, really why I want to check out the Audible original, see if there's something more in that story that had to be set aside because of converting it from an audiobook to a film. But the fact that both of them were written by the same writer, I'm like, was there some other cutting that had to be done? I'm so intensely curious. And I think that's a testament to the quality of the characters and the story they were living at the time, because I care. I want to know more. If I didn't like it, I would just say, meh, and just keep going to the next movie.
Right. Okay. Well, that's interesting. So I, from what I'm gathering, I think it sounds like this is one I could say that you probably liked it quite a bit more than I did. Is mm-hmm. that fair?
Probably. It intrigued me more. I appreciated the story they were trying to tell. You know, the daughter, even though she grew up in America, she kind of is a fish out of water just because of her culture, her heritage. And then she makes a new set of friends after her parents go back to India. And she's trying to cope with her mother's pressures. Her mother believes she's cursed. Her mother believes that, you know, she has to find a man, a husband before she's 30 or she'll be doomed. And then she finds a guy and mom doesn't like him, and she's like, "I, there's no pleasing you." I understand. I
Yeah,
mean, we see that a lot. But yeah, this I liked this one almost as much as I liked The Lie.
okay. All right, fair enough.
Yeah. How did you feel about Nocturne?
So Nocturne was certainly an interesting one for me because of the four films, it was the one I actually enjoyed the most while I was watching
Okay.
it. I just there was something about it I found quite engaging. It kept my attention. I liked the sense of pace. Particularly, I just found the setting interesting. I think that the whole world of classical music is certainly something that tends to be brushed off, as it were, when it comes to genre movies. And I thought that it really did an interesting job of summoning the spirits of that world.
Okay.
Of bringing to life that there is a whole animism within that that culture, as it were. That there's so many years of history that tie into it, and it's so easy to look at it as something sterile and stale. And I liked how it was using that backdrop and breathing this kind of three-dimensional life. You're used to thinking of kids going out and partying and dropping acid and listening to some kind of 60s psychedelic rock band, but here's kids that are at this classical music boarding school doing that.
Yes, they're listening to I guess they call it trip hop and dropping ecstasies.
But so I thought it was sort of interesting to have that going on and marrying it to Rachmaninoff. For me, the problem was is that as much as the movie engaged me, I felt like there was a whole lot of build up without a clear payoff. It had a really unnecessarily ambiguous and confusing ending. Now I it may be that maybe at the end of this we could get into some discussions of what that ending is. But to avoid spoilers, I'll just say that there's this whole the story really revolves around these two sisters. The one sister finds this music book from a student that has committed suicide that had been this prodigy student, and she starts playing and going through the pages and teaching herself from this book, which has all these illustrations, and the music seems to go through these different stages that look similar to something like a tarot reading, but it seems to be some kind of a path. The thing is, at the end, there's really no explanation of what this book is, where this comes from, and so it ends with it gives you this. It has this ambiguous book story that this story revolves around this music book that's never quite explained, and then it leads up to an ending that's ambiguous and never really quite explained. And it has these two sisters where the one is somewhat becomes somewhat the protagonist that becomes extremely envious of her other sister to the point of wanting to completely destroy her life, but the reasons for that are never entirely explained. And this is one of these things that comes down to it may play a lot better to people who like ambiguous horror or just ambiguity in their movies in general. Like, you know, as I said, to me, it was a little bit like watching a David Lynch film. In the end, of course, I shouldn't say that because David Lynch is, you're watching something
Off
that's
the wall.
right up to your own interpretation all the way through. There is this one, you think it's going to lead up to some kind of reveal, and instead it leads up to, now you make up what it, you decide what you want it to be about.
I don't think it was quite that bad in the ending, the ambiguity of the ending. There were clues about what was happening to her and why she got the book. I don't know. Why the student who wrote the book, because that was made kind of clear. The girl at the beginning who committed suicide, she created that. She wrote that. She drew those drawings and she wrote those, for lack of a better word, incantations. And the thing I think they were trying to get across, we can talk about this later when we go into spoiler territory. Whoever finds the book has to pick the sixth step for themselves. And I believe that the first girl's sixth choice or sixth incantation was different from, what's her name? Lily? Was that her name?
Juliet, maybe
Juliet.
the,
Okay, yeah.
yeah.
Her invocation, because we saw her draw that sixth one when she realized that it was torn out of the notebook that she found. But everything else happened the same way as it was in the book. And what I believe, and I'm going to try to figure out how to say this without spoiling it. The book came to her because she was stuck in a crisis moment of doubt and despair. And this book, the magic in it was going to help her overcome that. And now that I'm thinking about it, I'm like, well, wait a minute. The first girl was a prodigy coming in. This girl was only just average. So now I'm just confused myself.
Right. Yeah, I mean, to me, it seemed like the book was channeling some kind of, some kind of spirit energy, some kind of path, some kind of, for me, it was ambiguous if it was some kind of demon. I mean, obviously it ended in something pretty horrible for the original owner of the book. But I was waiting for there to be some explanation beyond, even if the girl who committed suicide wrote the book, there must have been something possessing her at the time she wrote it, to be, have these drawings of the these different phases of
The
life or.
different incidents, right?
Yeah.
And they don't make sense. They never reflected back to how they might have occurred in her life when they started happening all over again. We didn't see Juliet go. Actually, no, she did go digging. She went to look. She did some searching to find out what happened to the original girl and she noticed how certain things paralleled with what was in the book and what was happening to her. But nobody ever, she never made a further connection of that. She didn't go, why are these things happening this way? Can I stop this now that it started? I can't talk about this part because it would go into serious spoilers and it's killing me.
Right. So maybe we should do a overview and then we can go into spoiler territory to
Okay, yeah.
talk
So
about those. So, what would you give these overall?
I would rank them about the same as Black Box and the Lie, like three and a half. They're strong technical films. They Nocturne suffers from a story misdirect that doesn't go anywhere, and Evil Eye is a if you go in with a different set of expectations, Evil Eye would probably end up being the second best out of all of them. But you have to know what it's about before going into it, or else you'll be more disappointed. That's how I felt.
Yeah, certainly for myself, for me, these were both kind of 2-star movies in the end. I mean, Evil Eye had a lot of nice elements, but once you got past the charming elements of the family dynamic, the rest of what was going on in Evil Eye was nothing but a disappointment for me, who was really waiting for an evil eye to show up in the movie.
So would it be safe to say
And
that you give these rating all these movies ratings in the twos because they didn't meet the horror requirement? Like if you went in knowing ahead of time that they were not going to be up to your expectations of horror, where would you rank them? Like what rating would you give them?
well, for Evil Eye, I would still be giving it like a 2.
Okay.
And again, the issue that I'm still having with really all of them except for Nocturne was they just all felt too drawn out for my taste. Like every one of them, by the time it was over, I was just like, oh God, thank God it's over. Yeah, they just weren't tight and to the point enough. Nocturne engaged me all the way through, but I felt like the ending just was felt like a bit of a cop out. And so even there, because I felt like I went through this whole journey with the movie and then it left me unsatisfied, much as I enjoyed the ride. Getting to that ending left me feeling like now this is a 2-star as well.
So yeah, the ending for Nocturne was not satisfying compared to the build up. That's what you would say.
Yes.
Okay. So for me, the if I look at them as straight horror, like if I grade them on the horror expectation scale, yes, these are not 3-star movies, but the technical execution on some of them, the story execution on some of them raises it up to that. If I kind of, put my horror fangirl in a rear naked choke and shut her up for a couple minutes.
Yeah.
But yeah, I enjoyed all of them. If I were to have to like rank them in order, I would put The Lie first, Black Box second, Evil Eye third, Nocturne fourth. And depending on what question you ask me, I might flip two and three.
Okay. All right, so shall we talk spoilers?
Yes. Okay, people,
Okay.
if you're listening and you do not want to be spoiled on any of these films, skip ahead. Trust me, it'll be easier that way.
Okay.
Now.
All right. So here's the thing. So with Nocturne, you have Juliet. You see her sit down to do this grand final performance. She chickens out, she runs away, and she jumps off a roof and kills herself. And then it jumps straight over to her finishing the performance and standing up and to great applause. So my interpretation of maybe what was going on there, a couple different possibilities. One thought was that maybe the first scene where you see Juliet get up, run away, and jump off the building was that the real Juliet was sacrificing her life so that then some demon could come inhabit her body. And another way I was thinking about it was that the whole movie is some sort of metaphor. But I'm a little unclear on what that metaphor is for, but some sort of metaphorical killing of herself to, I don't know, killing of her young self to appease her star powerhood.
Nope.
Okay.
You want to try for number three? Okay. No, yes. All right. Well, let me put forth my theory and we'll see how far wrong we both are.
Okay.
Do you remember the scenes where Juliet was having visions of what was to happen? Do you remember some of those?
Vaguely, I mean,
All right, well,
where
there was one scene where she saw herself standing on stage, getting the standing ovation.
Oh, right.
Right. And I'm thinking, I'm still not 100% sure, but that was either a premonition or an alternate reality vision. And then there were the scenes where she saw a picture of, like, an image of the girl who killed herself at the beginning with her head bashed in, but she was smiling. She was happy. She was in a good place. And this is where that parallel breaks down for me. The girl at the beginning killed herself 6 weeks before this bravura performance she was supposed to have. All right. When we get to Juliet's performance, everything she's gone through, everything she's sacrificed, she is visualizing in her head that bravura performance, but with the sacrifice part, she has to invoke a sacrifice in order to achieve that pinnacle she's been seeking for. And this is where the theory breaks down. I believed we were going to see, since she was a twin, not an identical twin, but a twin, I thought we were going to see her either sacrifice herself to restore her sister or sacrifice her sister to get rid of her literal demons of jealousy. And neither of that happened. So I'm like, what the fuck is going on? And my interpretation of, spoiler alert, Juliet jumps too. But she's, remember how she's laying on the sculptor? She's dying, she's bleeding, but
Right.
in her head, she's doing the performance. She's getting the standing ovation. She's getting the roses. She's dying happy because she achieved her goal. Now, whether or not that magic that she invoked, maybe the first girl saw the same thing, maybe something in that book, their insecurities and their happiness, their delusions are fueling the magic for the next one. I don't know. That's it. The way it ended, I expected people to come pouring out the building going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And that didn't happen. And that's where I went, okay, I don't get it.
Well, and even, see, for me, one of the reasons I was thinking, I did have that thought that she really jumped, but that in her mind she was completing the performance and was happy. I had that thought too, but the reason why I was discounting that was you saw her laying, bleeding out on the sculpture, and the students are walking by, and it's and they're just like not fazed. They're just like walking by, like whatever.
And that's yeah, that's weird because it's like, okay, are they noticing? Did they not notice it? Is this part of the spell? Because it looked like in death she was being ignored by everybody, like she was in life. I'm like, it was that the point of this? I don't understand.
Yeah, see, for me, that was why I was having the interpretation that this maybe is some sort of metaphorical sacrifice or some sort of, okay, this is the real Juliet that just died, but nobody even sees it because this demon instead has now taken over and is what's actually visible to ordinary mortals.
But,
while the real Juliet is bleeding out on this.
And if that's accurate, what happened to the one that was supposed to take the place of the other girl? What happened there? Because it didn't.
Right.
Yeah, it doesn't. It's not a match. So I'm like very confused.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Again, this just comes back to, you know, for me, it's just altogether disappointing in the end because it brought together all these elements that really kept me interested and had me wanting to find out, you know, what's going on? What is up with this book? What is up with, you know, all this stuff that this girl is getting herself into? I guess the other thing for me is I was sort of hoping that, okay, whatever this crazy path is, it led the first girl to kill herself. But where is it going to go with Juliet? Where is she going to go with it? And it just leads, at some level, it just leads to her going and killing herself too, rather than doing something different with it.
Yeah. And like that, I think that negates the entire point of the sister's little heartfelt revelation right before the performance. And I was like, well, what was the point of that? Other than to explain why Juliet's stage fright damaged her confidence, you know, 15 years earlier, however, you know, when she was, what, eight, whenever they did that. At least that was the impression I got, that Juliet's sister didn't have a performance anxiety attack, but Juliet did, and that ruined her quote unquote potential. And that whole thing, like with the parents meeting the teacher with both sisters there, that whole thing got weird. Going, why are you pushing our children to play classical music when there's no future in it because nobody listens to classical anymore? And it's like, really, Mom? You couldn't have done this 10 years earlier and, you know, given them both guitars and said, here, play rock and roll? Seriously? Nocturne was beautifully executed, but I don't think there was a complete story there to hang that on. And that's no matter how my opinions will change or might change about the other three movies, Nocturne is at the bottom of the barrel. And it may fall even farther to the bottom with the four new ones we get next year.
All right. Well, fair enough. So I think we've probably said what we have to say about these ones.
Quite likely, quite likely. I think I'm gonna I really think I am gonna give Evil Eye another viewing because there's a couple little things I want to satisfy my curiosity about. But
Yeah,
the
well, I'll be interested to know if you do actually wind up listening to that Audible book.
I am going to investigate that forthwith. And see if it's where it is out there and see if I can grab a copy of it because I like I said I am intrigued. And I think it's funny that the two films that intrigue me the most are Black Box and Evil Eye because there's something about both of those stories that makes me want to find out more. Now, The Lie was entertaining just because of, oh my God, how can these people make such stupid decisions?
Yeah.
But yeah, but there, it's like it literally is like Black Box and Evil Eye are just like 90% complete as stories. I don't know if they'd be better if they were 75 minutes long instead of 90, or if they would survive being pushed to closer to 2 hours? I'm not sure. I don't think I could have taken 2 hours of The Lie though, because that just got too slow in a couple of places.
Yeah. Well, certainly for me, I already said last week I thought Black Box could have been cut in half, and then it would have been much
Half, wow.
but
I don't know if I would have gone in half, but definitely like 70, 75 minutes easily. There could easily have been 15, 20 minutes pulled out of there. Oh, well.
All right. Well,
Well,
I guess that's,
thank you.
yeah.
I enjoy diving into film discussions, especially where we can nitpick stuff, because that's the fun of watching a lot of these movies and TV shows, right?
Right.
Well, look for our reviews. Noah has written a review of The Lie, which should be up on the website by now, and my review for Evil Eye will be forthcoming post haste. Thank you
All right.
again
Well, thanks. All right.
for.
Thanks a lot, Summer.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Hey there, Mer Lafferty, co-editor of Escape Pod here. And I just wanted to let you know, if you are listening to this podcast right now, then you probably would enjoy our very first print anthology. Escape Pod, our 15th anniversary print anthology, will feature a mix of stories, some of which have been on the site, some are reprints that may be new to you, and some are brand new stories from people like T. Kingfisher, Maurice Broaddus, Greg Van Eekhout, and our own Tina Connolly. I also contributed a story featuring the universe from my book, Six Wakes. So if you are in the UK, you can get your copy October 20th, and if you're in the US, you can get your copy on November 17th. But check it out. We're pretty proud of what we've done with this, just like we're pretty proud with what we've done with this entire podcast for the past 15 years.
This is Kevin Murphy from Mystery Science Theater 3000 and Rift Tracks, and you have bitten off a nice big chunk of Slice of Sci-Fi.
Hey, And yeah, take a look at the website for the reviews. Both Noah and I chose one to review. He picked The Lie. I've picked Evil Eye. And weigh in on those. I'm now very, very curious to see what the next four movies in this Amazon Blumhouse series are. I don't think we're going to see them till January or February of 2021, if I remember the release notes correctly. I don't even know what the names of them are, so we'll see. We'll see where those go. But what other horror or horror-adjacent stories are you enjoying? Feel free to call in. The number is 602-635-6976, or shoot me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play Podcasts, TuneIn, Player FM, and iHeartRadio Podcasts. And if you are listening on Apple or Stitcher, please leave us a review. Let other people know you are enjoying the podcast and they should check it out for themselves. Every little bit helps. Raising the profile on different platforms helps get more eyes and ears on the show and hopefully more support, more donors, maybe a sponsor here and there. You can follow us on Twitter at Slice of Sci-Fi. You can head on over to YouTube, youtube.com/sliceofscifi. And of course, there is the website, sliceofscifi.com. Weigh in on the very many interviews and reviews we are doing. Your comments, suggestions, and conversations are welcome. I'd like to thank everyone who is currently supporting this show. Your pledges, your donations really do help keep things online around here. Keep the lights on, so to speak. Keep the websites online. Keep the media online for everyone to continue enjoying these podcasts. If you can, add your support. The place to go is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. And if you're a patron, you get perks. Read the details on the different tiers. And if you can, add your support. Thank you. If a monthly pledge is not something you can or want to commit to right now, the PayPal link is there. Once a year, five times a year, every week, whatever suits your budget, that link is there. PayPal.me/sci-fi summer. And again, everyone who is supporting by either donating or spreading the word, thank you. Thank you so much. And that'll do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening. And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.